blood. Power. Power in the blood.
Spin doctors, medicine, corporation, government, selling me some cover-up, weaponizing pesticides, poison in my groceries, nothing but another drug, a license they can buy and sell. No, I don't mind dying.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. This is Jacqueline Keeler, your co-host du jour, and...
I'm the regular weekly host of the program, Paul Rowland. And today we are going to be talking about Elizabeth Warren as she steps up her run for the presidency in 2020. Questions continue over her claims to Native ancestry and how she has handled, especially how she has handled the controversy, I think. But as undisputed Native journalists, leaders, and spokespeople continue to be called upon by the media to weigh in on this lingering question, real issues facing Indigenous people and nations are overlooked and ignored. And I've got, of course, with me my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who is a Portland-based Diné, Yankton, Dakota writer and activist. And we have on the telephone Jenny Monet, award-winning journalist and tribal citizen of the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico, who writes about Indigenous rights and injustice in the United States and around the world. She's also executive producer and host of the podcast Still Here, and you can also check out her personal website. All of that information is on our program page at Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.fm.
Good morning, Jenny. Is she there? Hello?
Hello, good morning.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
So we loved your article that you wrote about colonized newsrooms that are ignoring Indian country. And of course, the big news in Indian country right now is the swearing in of two Native American women, Native American congresswomen, Deb Haaland from New Mexico and Charisse Davids from Kansas. And Deb Haaland is actually from your tribe, from your Pueblo, Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico.
Yes, that's correct. As I have even told Representative Haaland herself, it's impossible to not have Pueblo pride, even though I'm a journalist and she's a politician, and my job is to cover politicians.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing moment. I don't think that any of us saw this coming. Did you see it coming? I mean, two Native congresswomen in one.
No, I think we all thought that maybe, we had the hopeful ambition that one would break through the political glass ceiling in Congress, but it's a really remarkable time to be Indigenous, number one, and to be Indigenous and a woman. And so I think there was a little bit of inspiration in that when I wrote what I did the day that they were sworn in.
So so you were watching the news and you saw... Tell me what you saw, what inspired you to write this piece, because it's a critique, because the focus of the mainstream news is so different than what the focus is, what Native people would be interested in hearing.
Yeah. So first of all, just thanks for having me on and giving a little nod to what I did write. It's nice to know when you put something out there and it resonates. I had been approached the day of the swearing in by a network television producer. The network will go unnamed, but I was approached to join a panel about Elizabeth Warren. And when I had mentioned to the producer that there was actually history happening right before our eyes that very day involving two Native American women who had been sworn in historically for the first time into the U.S. House of Representatives, and suggested that perhaps, Elizabeth Warren take a rest for the day so that we could honor actual Native American tribal citizens. It was it was not unlike a lot of the conversations, unfortunately, that I have with a lot of these editorial gatekeepers in these colonized newsrooms. You know, they are fixated on a certain agenda, and there's very little sway that happens when they have their mind set. And at this stage, they had really already had their panel stacked, and they were looking for a Native American who had some kind of criticism against Elizabeth Warren based on what I had written was expired controversy over her silly DNA test and now her run for the presidency.
Maybe you could go ahead and I was really interested in having you read your piece just to kind of give people an idea of what, or maybe the part that you would wish to read right now.
Oh, sure. How would you like, just stop me, I guess, whenever.
Okay. No, because you go over some of this in the piece itself, so I thought maybe we could just you could.
Oh, sure.
You would,
it's been really interesting, actually. It's been picked up by several, you know, I guess, outlets, and they've kind of all made their small, slight adjustments, including Medium, where I published the original piece under the independent page that I created called Indigenously. And the original title was something to the effect of An Afterthought No More. So it's been kind of altered somewhat to read the headline as Two Indigenous Women Are Now Part of Congress But Mainstream Media Barely Took Notice. Indigenous Representation Must No Longer Be An Afterthought.
Okay,
this was published January 4th. Fourth, the day after Holland and Davids were sworn in. Okay. I got the call around the time I was scrolling my Twitter feed, wiping my eyes dry over the immense promise I felt watching newly elected Indigenous Congresswoman Representative Deb Holland and Representative Sharice Davids share that heartfelt hug on the House floor. It was a cable news producer from a network that will remain anonymous, and he was calling to book a panel. He'd heard I knew a few things about Native Americans and the geopolitical frame of reference, except that's not what he wanted to talk to me about. He wanted to know if I could sit on a televised segment to discuss Elizabeth Warren. The news producer yammered on while I continued to gaze at Twitter, feasting on photo after photo of history literally happening right before my eyes. Two Native American women like me were doing what had never been done before, breaking into one of the highest political arenas in the land. I waited until the producer stopped talking. I politely told him that the problem with Warren isn't expired controversy over her silly DNA test and now her bid for the presidency. Rather, I said it's Warren and the media itself capitalizing on this issue and ignoring the very Native Americans central to the debate, arguably the most marginalized voices in the country. I suggested the segment be realigned to focus on the day's unprecedented inauguration of Davids and Holland into the U.S. House of Representatives, that this was a true moment in democracy that the world should be watching. But he said the panel was mostly booked to discuss the Democratic Party's dilemma over whether to support Warren. He wanted a voice critical of the Massachusetts senator and assumed that this person would be me, both Democrat and anti-Warren. He said mention of Davids and Holland could be an aside, an afterthought. There's nothing new about Indian country getting short shrift in the media, in politics, or in life in general. And there is certainly nothing unusual about outsiders looking in, assuming that all Native Americans represent a monolith, that we all vote Democrat, that we think alike, and that we'll go along with whatever corporate agenda is put in front of us. In this case, a conversation about Elizabeth Warren. But the election of Holland and Davids represents a resounding call for change, and the time has come for Indigenous inhabitants of these lands to become a priority in the American narrative. Last year marked my 20th anniversary of being a career journalist, a profession I entered into because the very people and places I come from across Indian country simply were not being seen in my news feeds or were being featured in cringeworthy ways. Even today, it's common to see non-Indigenous journalists go to an Indian reservation and treat it like it's some kind of developing country. And in many ways, they'd be socioeconomically accurate based on the latest report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, which highlights the need to honor the treaties broken by the U.S. government. But that's the problem. rarely does the journalism match the indigenous point of view. Today, Indian country is comprised of roughly 2.6 million tribal citizens who live either on ancestral lands now restricted by trust relationships with the federal government, i.e. reservations, or ancestral lands stolen and now shared with the offspring of immigrants in cities across the U.S. But this narrative, this decolonized way of viewing the origin story of America, is rarely, if ever, discussed in a way that's accepted as Western journalism. Rather, these indigenous points of view are relegated to the opinion column. There remains no designated journalism real estate in the established elite press for the original voices of America. For this reason, I made a deliberate pivot a few years ago to work independently so I could go to the places that few newsrooms would send me. And despite my professional gains, it's also worked to my disadvantage. The amount of time and energy to be seen and heard by editors on stories of national importance from Indian country is daunting and often the most difficult part of my job. To be sure, the story about former Representative Bob Goodlatte of Virginia blocking the most promising bill addressing violence against Native Americans was a lead I couldn't convince any of my clients to invest in, even though I had been writing about this issue for them previously. In this regard, the editorial fickleness I contend with is on par with Goodlatte's message: indigenous issues just don't matter that much. I've stewed over these inequalities in the media, and I found some peace, but then I got that call from the network producer. To be fair, indigenous media is problematic as well. The day of Hollins and David swearing in, I was driving across the homelands of the Spirit Lake Nation and grew annoyed, agitated even, hearing the live call-in radio show, Native America Calling. The conversation wasn't focused on the energizing history happening in Washington, D.C., as one might expect. Rather, the host and guest were talking about indigenous herbal teas. I couldn't bear to listen anymore. Realizing the squandered media resources of that moment, I was compelled to turn the program off, and I did. Like our ancestors, those of us who crave the indigenous narrative must forage for the sustenance of our media diets, hunt for it in digital territories like Facebook and Twitter to nourish our minds. But this has to change, and Holland and David's are emblematic of this call to action. Time has run out to convince colonized newsrooms that indigenous issues and perspectives matter in a way that is legitimate rather than opinionated. Patience has worn paper thin for Indian country to be seen worthy of first-class journalism on a daily basis, as opposed to the kind of reactionary framework that we saw at Standing Rock. The hunger for validation from the legacy press of the authentic indigenous narrative is no longer malnourishment, but a famine imposed on our very democracy. We cannot understand the story of this great nation without including the indigenous narrative. Representative Holland and I come from the same Pueblo. Seeing her at the U.S. House dressed in our traditional manta and moccasins was immensely powerful, but it cannot and should not be one of the only stories of this moment in our news feeds. As she tweeted, Holland was integral in efforts to partially reopen the government and pass bills that fund tribal services, although, as she quipped, inadequately so. These are the headlines that should become the follow-up story, not the history itself. And because so few others are doing this, it will unravel here. Our stories deserve more than that, an afterthought no more.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jenny. Yeah, wow. I don't know what to add to that. It's just, you said it so perfectly. I just love so many of the phrases in there. And it's, yeah, I, so what, what further reporting are you going to do on what do you have planned to sort of focus more attention on this?
Well, I find it interesting that I know that you are very active in the conversation and the debate around Elizabeth Warren, to which I really am not. I'm a neutral observer, and I respect the debate and the conversation. I think it elevates a lot of people's awareness and education on indigenous identity, the political ramifications of who we are in that kind of political identity, rather than as opposed to a racial identity. I appreciate the conversation, but for me, I think it's clear in what I wrote that this is really about representation in the media and in this space. it's as I mentioned, a career of mine of 20 years. I care very deeply about the craft of journalism, but also very deeply about the Indigenous narrative, how it's handled, how it's represented, and also when it is mishandled. And I think all of us as Indigenous people see that routinely and are quite offended when we see threats to that narrative, because the reality is we have generations of scholars, academics, journalists, and other thinkers who have paved the way for us to get to where we are at a place where there is this kind of heightened awareness that predated, say, for instance, an incident like Standing Rock. You know, if we think of great thinkers like your relative, Jacqueline Vine-Deloria, you know, calling a spotlight to, say, for instance, an issue very central to the Elizabeth Warren debate, the Cherokee grandmother syndrome.
Yes. He wrote extensively about that, yeah.
Exactly. And those concepts, those ideas, I mean, they aren't new, and they certainly aren't new to Indigenous peoples. And, you know, I think that that's what I find what compels me to, I think push back in a different way, meaning that rather than give the microphone over to discuss an Elizabeth Warren debate, I think everyone should have a responsibility to say, actually, there's other matters to discuss as well. Because what we saw in Trump was that, you know, did the media machine kind of feed into the creation of Trump, and could we be repeating that history around an Elizabeth Warren?
Exactly. I totally agree with your perspective, and I'm engaged in this, but I did not want to. Do you know what I mean? And it, you know, I feel like I'm being asked to write about it again, the issue of Warren. You know, I feel like I'm being forced to rewrite an assignment over and over again, almost as punishment, you know. And mm-hmm. I would prefer to write about other things. And in fact, I have many other articles I'm working on that are crucial to Indian country, like ICWA, like MMIW, and which you've also covered, and you covered homelessness in The Guardian. You know, there's all these other issues we want to be working on, and yet we're forced to dance to this tune, you know, that's being set by this sort of back and forth between two powerful white Americans, you know, and that she's taking. I totally agree with that. So what other you go ahead and ask that. So.
Well, no, I was since we have you on for a relatively short time, I wanted to just what particular issues. Crucial issues that are you looking at and reporting on right now?
So I just wrapped up a year of investigating what started as gender violence in Indian country and what ended as violence in Indian country. And if that kind of defines the scope of what my findings are, I'm now doing a great unpacking of a year of field reporting, note-taking, data gathering, lots of story foraging, and it's quite exciting. It's almost intimidating in a way, because what we're seeing about this narrative of violence in Indian country is largely couched in a very trendy gender violence narrative, hung on the rung of quote-unquote hashtag Me Too. And, you know, my job before me is to really kind of push back on that as well. I think so much of what we do in the Indigenous media space is debunking outsider notions of who they think we are, because the reality is they don't know us.
Exactly. And the level of intellectual work it takes to do that, and also to figure what you're doing, which is figuring out how to place those stories, how to challenge business as usual in the way they report about us. And I also want you to go in a little bit about you know, we've talked about this before, you and I privately, about your you know, that you are a trained journalist. You went to Columbia Journalism School, and you put in the effort and the time to learn your craft, But you also have issue with the way mainstream media places Native people mostly in the opinion section. Could you explain what the difference is between that sort of venue and real, you know, investigative reporting?
Sure. I don't slight anyone for writing in the opinion section, even journalists. I personally make it my mission to stay away from the opinion column because I am a formally trained journalist and a career journalist, and I toe a pretty fine line in arguing that what I write is steeped in fact-finding and source gathering and critique, that it belongs in bona fide journalism strands and spaces. I think that opinion, let me roll it back. I think that the opinion column does amplify Indigenous voices, as we are seeing from a number of very talented writers coming from Indian country. If I had to be somewhat critical about it, I worry that it continues to, I think, keep the indigenous narrative in this advocacy-driven space. However, if you know anything about the birth of indigenous media, it was born out of advocacy with the rise of the Cherokee Phoenix, the first indigenous newspaper in what we now call present-day America. And that newspaper was in large part to be a megaphone for the Cherokee people themselves to fight against their own forced removal of their homelands in what is present-day Georgia. And that really hasn't changed today. Jody Rave, our colleague from who's Mandan Hidatsa Narikara in North Dakota, put out a very fine media study at the end of this year, which looked at press freedom in Indian country and found that the majority of newspapers were tribally owned, which she argued translated into being censored. And when you look at that kind of muzzle on the hyper-local news coming from our tribal communities, there's got to be some real eye-opening pushback when it comes to what we're demanding with the legitimacy of the indigenous narrative and in the spaces that they belong. And that's where, when I write, if I'm writing anything that is opinion related, it will likely only be around indigenous media the advocacy for uplifting the indigenous narrative in these legitimate established media spaces.
Because, of course, the danger is if we're ghettoized to the opinion section, the implication is that our critique is subjective, right? It's not, and it can be dismissed.
Well, I think that opinions, I personally love the conversation that opinionated essays, when they're well-researched, are oftentimes, more powerful than, say, a news article. And we've seen that, and they have Pulitzer Prizes for these and other prizes for opinionated essays. But there's no degradation on it in that realm. But, again, the indigenous media space has largely been defined by an advocacy-driven definer, right? It's largely been viewed and couched in this very advocacy-driven way, and rarely has it been embraced as elite journalism, as elite nonfiction that is sourced by, and I hate to say it, by colonized news standards. But that's really where I try to focus the work that I do, and why I've even gone so far to even challenge anonymously the clients that I work for in the colonized news space to come to some kind of middle ground where the indigenous narrative meets the colonial standards of journalism today.
We've got a kind of a full show. We're going to have you on, Jenny, I think for, I'm not sure, maybe 10 more minutes or so, mm-hmm. and then we've got some taped stuff to include. But of course, this, as always, is a call-in show, so your calls are welcome. Questions and comments for both my regular co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, and our guest on the phone, Jenny Monet. And the number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187.
I actually got to go to Washington, D.C. and attend the swearing-in and to interview both Holland, Representatives Holland and Sharice Davids, who is Ho-Chunk and representing Kansas. And it was an amazing moment. And I'm still, I'm a bit of a slow writer. I think I'm still collating all my data and transcribing my interviews and everything. I actually did interview some Pueblo women about the issue, and I would love to hear your point of view on this. They felt that this was actually sort of a challenge to the patriarchal sort of government in the Pueblos themselves, because Pueblo women were able to step over it and practice leadership in other venues.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's even though there are certain balances in Pueblo society within, matriarchal roles, in large part, the patriarchy does kind of dictate how women are to be seen and heard, and that also includes whether or not there are women in leadership positions, and it's rare. And I believe that Deb Holland had to perhaps contend with that in her own way. I've had conversations with Representative Holland just in terms of the kind of acceptance that she's received from the Pueblo leadership in New Mexico, particularly pertaining to our own Pueblo, the Laguna Pueblo. And I know firsthand, just in being a representative of the Pueblo, as someone who has been in the public eye as a broadcaster, it's slow to understand whether or not our relatives see us and see us in a way that's acceptable. And all one can do is to walk with that kind of dignity, with our ancestors behind us, in the way that we respond first to our tribal communities. And I believe that that's what transcended Representative Holland to be embraced, not just by the Pueblo of Laguna, but, the All Pueblo Governors Council in New Mexico, and all of Indian country for that matter.
Yeah, I was told that Pueblo, your Pueblo was the last to announce support.
And yes, we're tough. I'm not gonna lie, I think I wasn't surprised at all. In fact, it was one of the first questions when I first had my very first conversation with Representative Holland following her following election night. It was one of my first questions to her, was how the Pueblo had responded to her victory.
And I should, the Pueblo, how many, how large is your tribe population-wise?
It's roughly around 8,000 in population, 4,000 on the reservation, and 4,000 off.
And it's just near Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yeah, about 50 miles west of Albuquerque, if you're going towards Gallup, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the opportunity to work as a community organizer with different Rio Grande Pueblos, and then I spent the next year working on Eastern Navajo in communities, and I did notice a real difference. When I'd have a meeting in the Pueblos, there would be only women would come. We were talking about things they wanted to do for their children and planning projects, and I'd help them get them funded, and then when I did it in Eastern Navajo, it was couples that came, men and women, and they participated equally. And it was very, that's not even exaggerated. That was the way it was. And it was interesting because it definitely felt like the Pueblos were had a different way of doing things than my own tribe, the Navajo Nation.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was writing about. You know, Indian country is not a monolith, and you know, each pocket of our homelands represents a people that you know, walk in their own way, and that certainly is the case in Pueblo country versus Lakota country versus you know, the Pacific Northwest. We could go on and on.
Well, I just want to reintroduce the guest, the voices you are hearing on this program. Mine is Paul Rowland. I'm the regular weekly host of Wednesday Talk Radio. You just heard Jenny Monet, who we have on the phone, who is, as you've been hearing, Laguna Pueblo citizen and a 20-year career journalist. And we started out by talking about a piece that she wrote, which has different names, but is one version of which is linked to on our Wednesday Talk Radio program page at kbo.fm, and is about the continuing controversy over Elizabeth Warren and how it overshadows important issues that need to be reported on more than that in Indian country. And my regular second Wednesday co-host, who is here in this KBOO studio, is Jacqueline Keeler, who is a Portland-based Native journalist. And we are so glad to have her on a once-a-month basis. And as we're halfway through the program, I'm not sure how much longer you're able to stay with us, Jenny, but we do have our first caller who is anonymous. Go ahead, you're on the air.
I just wonder, what is the subject? What is her point? I have been listening, and I don't get it.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to explain. Well, I'm sorry if you haven't been able to get the point. I'm not sure we can reiterate it in a brief period of time. As I just said, we're Jenny Monet read her article that she wrote about the ignoring, overshadowing of important issues facing Native and that are lived by Native Americans in this country. And
well, I think it's the issue. It has to do with the fact that we don't control so many of the venues in which issues that are important to us are discussed. You know, whether it's newsrooms, whether it's you know, having written articles about you know, Native literature, whether it's publishers, you know, talking to artists, whether it's museums and galleries, you know, these places that define what Native art is, Native journalism, Native you know, literary champions, all of that we have no control over because they are spaces controlled by primarily white Americans. And in fact, most of the purchasers and consumers are white Americans. And so often their lens is the primary lens used to understand us.
I just want to mention that coming up at 9, the radio activists will talk to the Portland Parents Union about school kids facing push out in the classroom. Then a visit from Unite Oregon and their work combating hate crimes. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, the Dirtbag talks fruit tree care and veggie garden planning, plus your gardening questions. All these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you haven't yet and would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. This is KBOO Community Radio. And I'm Paul Rowland.
So, Jenny, I wanted to actually, I've been getting my, I told you I've been getting all my interviews done, but I do have one I wanted to play, and sadly it's not one from Deb Holland or Charisse Davids, who I also interviewed, but it's actually from Mark Ruffalo.
Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and play that interview?
I'm glad to be here, man.
What a story to get.
So tell me how you feel about this event, about the election of two Native women.
I just, I never really enjoy coming to D.C. It's kind of usually a depressing place to come. But something's changed here, and I just couldn't be more excited about the diversity of this new Congress, and I couldn't be more excited to see Native women here. It feels like a real new shift and new beginning for our country of what will be known as the Native century. Throughout
that,
the world.
Do you think that Native leaders bring something special to
the root of our existence?
I do. I think the struggle, the suffering, has engendered a real resilience and wisdom in Native people, but especially carried in the Native women. From what I know of Native history, women were equal to the men in leadership. And the fact that at this moment in time, with so much uncertainty, while at the same time so much opportunity for this country and the world, it just seems symbolically really significant that we're welcoming the first Native American women into Congress. I see it as a real boon of a hopefulness, and I just think that Native people carry a kind of wisdom and heart action that's really needed at this moment in time.
So that was interesting. You had a voice in the background. Who was that, and what was the event?
That event was on Thursday night, and it was held at the Hyatt Hotel in D.C., and it was to honor Representatives Deb Haaland of New Mexico and Representative Sherrese Davids of Kansas. And in the background, when I started talking to Mark Ruffalo, she wasn't reading, that's why we were trying to speak very quietly. And so, but that was Joy Harjo. She is she's a Muskogee Creek poet, an amazing poet, and she was asked to read. She lives in New Mexico. She's friends with Deb Haaland, so she was asked to read. And so I think she lives in Oklahoma now, but she lived in New Mexico for many years and Hawaii. And so, I got to spend a lot of time with her as well. She's amazing. And so she's, but yeah, it's, so what do you, Jenny?
I'm here.
Yeah. So what did you think of what he had to say? You probably encountered him quite a bit because he was at Standing Rock.
Well, I have interviewed Mark Ruffalo as well, and I find him to be just a strong, strong example of an ally, to how to be an ally to Indigenous peoples. He is humble. He is not in the way. He doesn't pretend to know things, and he shares the insight that speaks to him as an outsider, and that is so helpful. That's what allies need to do for other allies, right? To foster and grow alliances with other people who are non-Indigenous, but who are interested in uplifting Indigenous peoples. And I've often just seen that with the kind of involvement and representation that Mark Ruffalo has had, not only from Standing Rock, but he also was back in North Dakota for lead up to the election over the voting rights disenfranchisement that was happening, which disproportionately affected tribal citizens in the state. And I was not surprised to see that he was in Washington, D.C. for this very historic moment. And I also just wanted to say, Jackie, I'm so glad that you were there as well. I was considering going as well, but then I thought, you know what, there's going to be lots of other good voices there, and I can't wait to see what everybody writes.
I wish you would have been there. I always love doing things with you and hanging out with you. But I'd also like to say that you were covering the midterms there in North Dakota, the voting sort of repression going on. And also you were, in case our audience doesn't know this, but you were covering Standing Rock. You were there almost the entire time. And you were actually arrested for doing journalism in Standing Rock.
That's correct. I was the only credentialed journalist on the scene the day I was arrested, February 1st, 2017. And despite showing my press credentials and obeying the orders by police, I was still arrested and detained for 30 hours, was denied a phone call, and still had to endure 16 months of protracted litigation to basically
prove the legitimacy of my profession as a journalist. I went to court, had a bench trial that lasted 8 hours, which resulted in my acquittal, which I'm very grateful for. And, you know, in the rear view, looking at that whole experience, I didn't realize it then the way that I do now, but my very profession and reputation was on the line. And I still take issue with that, in that, you know, as journalists, our name and our transparency and who we are and how we represent ourselves, that's all we really have as journalists. And, you know, it could have been quite damaging had the verdict gone a different way. But I'm just really grateful that I had the United Indian Nation to fund my legal defense fund. I had a very powerful team of attorneys to represent me. On the counter to that, I would also just add that I was fortunate and very privileged in that regard, because I know that there are many other people who were practicing their First Amendment rights in a freedom to assemble that were not afforded that same kind of luxury of representation, legal representation. And I think that this other lesson that I walked away with my arrest, is that the First Amendment is quite uneven, if not unequal, when it comes to the privileges afforded to, say, press freedom versus the right to protest, for instance. And I think we're starting to see that now, particularly in the lead up, as we look into, say, for instance, Keystone XL protesting, that is being discussed, and how governments are already kind of in a preparation working to counter these kind of perceived protests that might be happening.
Passing laws to outlaw protest. And also there's a famous photo of you holding a sign that says journalism is not a crime. And was that sign donated to the press museum in D.C.? Or I know you were saying
not yet, but I've been approached to maybe consider putting it in some kind of you know, formal archive in that realm, whether it's at the museum or any other kind of collection that you know, is looking at either Press Freedom or Standing Rock. Right now, it's in my own personal archives.
Great. Well, great. Thank you so much. And we look forward to reading more about what you're going to write. And I encourage everyone to check our page and check out her writing, check out her journalism. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you, Jacqueline. And thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
All right. So I don't know if that caller who expressed frustration earlier was wanting more about Elizabeth Warren, but we do have that tape, which we'll run in a minute. But Jacqueline, I know this is a story that's been overdone, and probably you'd prefer to get away from it, but some new things have happened. I wonder if you could just talk about some of the gory details.
Yeah, I guess we could put these links up on the page too, but yeah. I in November, I co-wrote an article about Elizabeth Warren's DNA claims and why these are actually harmful to, they feed into right-wing sponsored threats against Native sovereignty, in particular an ICWA case, an Indian Child Welfare Act case that was ruled on in Texas, a federal case, finding the term Indian itself to be unconstitutional in violation of the 14th and 5th Amendments because it is race-based. And this is a argument being pushed by the Goldwater Institute, which is an incredibly right-wing institute. They've spent the past 18 years trying to get a case, they've been shopping around for courts and cases, and their goal is to get a split circuit court decision and then have the Supreme Court pick that up and then get the term Indian outlawed. In which case, many of the legal situations like treaties, laws like the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, the Indian Civil Rights Act, you know, and of course the Indian Child Welfare Act, all will be, you know, thrown into doubt. It's a kind of a very clean way of dismantling Native political status in this country, and it's pretty clever. And of course, the Goldwater Institute spent a long time pursuing this particular strategy. And the unfortunate thing is that Warren, you know, in her attempt to play hardball with Trump, you know, to try to get him to call him on his $1 million bet that, you know, with the DNA thing, which, you know, it made us basically a plaything between two powerful people. Right. And we may really pay a serious price for this game. In the sense that being such a high-profile situation, her endorsement of DNA, basically as a way to prove some sort of Indian identity, feeds into the general perception that we are race-based. And sadly, judges and even chief Supreme Court justices, they don't know a lot about Indians. I mean, if you read the different court decisions, they don't even know Indian federal law. It's not required to pass the bar. And Sotomayor said that she did not know any Indian federal law till she was on the Supreme Court. So they don't know the law regarding our status. And so they can be influenced by, you know, sort of semiotic, you know, sort of speech like this, like DNA, and begin, that will feed into very serious and real political and legal outcomes for Native people that will be extremely detrimental. And that was the point of my article. And So
talk about this Washington Post article.
Well, my friend Rebecca Nagel wrote about it also in the Washington Post. She's a Cherokee Nation citizen. While I was in D.C., I kept getting all these Twitter tags and stuff like that. And apparently the Huffington Post issued an article claiming that the mainstream media was making a big deal about this and Native people were okay with it. That they spoke to a handful of Native people and they said they were okay with it. And that's, you know, I ignored it for quite a while because I was busy, you know, traveling and, you know, doing other things, interviewing people in D.C. And finally, I looked at it and on a Friday afternoon when I was trying to sleep, and I had to respond. It was like, you know, first of all, we're being published in these mainstream news outlets. Native people are. You know, these are Native voices speaking out, whitewashing us and sort of claiming that it's white men writing in these mainstream things is wrong. You know, my piece was published by NBC News. We worked really hard to get into these spaces, and then to claim that we're white people writing is completely offensive, you know, and dismissive. And they didn't even deal with our arguments. They just simply found other Indians to counter us. And that's exactly what they did with the treaties. They found Indians. You can find Indians to do whatever you want, just like you can find people who question climate change in America, you know, and you can find a scientist who questions climate change, one scientist, you know. But I mean, that doesn't mean that the issue at hand is not real. Mm-hmm. And so I just said that they need to address us on the merits of our arguments, you know, not just find another Indian to say, this is my Indian and my Indian says it's okay. That is business as usual in this country. It's colonialism. It's silencing. And I agree with Jenny that, you know, this discussion of Warren should not displace the incredible momentous moment and occasion of two Native congresswomen being sworn in. And I don't want to engage this, but I was forced to engage it because, you know, they wouldn't let it die. I mean, all Warren ever had to do was apologize, and it would have gone away.
Well, let's just focus on that really briefly. So that's the feeling. It just seems like the big issue, in addition to the absurdity of her conceding to that DNA test, which was, as you said, just falling into the just playing a dangerous and bad game that it can only reflect bad on Native people, but the way she's handled this, has she seems like she could have laid this to rest a long time ago and done it in a way that actually increased, you know, first of all, support in Indian country and even broader support.
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of Cherokee people, the two Cherokee genealogists who did her genealogy. They are the official genealogists for the Cherokee Nation. They're the best in the field, and they did her genealogy in 2012. They told me that if they were told 6 years ago that they would still be dealing with this, they would have been shocked, because they just thought that she would sit down and talk to them, that they could talk about her family tree and then also talk about, you know, how Cherokee's kinship relates to each other, have a nice conversation about it. They never expected. And in fact, one of them, Twyla Barnes, she said that she got death threats from Warren supporters in 2012. Her children got death threats. They were teenagers at the time. And it's, you know, we expect to just, this is not a threatening issue for us to talk about, you know, the way in which many American families have stories about being Native, but some of them, a lot of them are not true, sadly enough. And particularly for Cherokees, it's an epidemic. It's on a scale that most people cannot conceive of. Even myself, we don't have people claiming to be Navajo. That doesn't really happen that often. But for the Cherokees, it's absolutely out of control. And I've talked to many Cherokee historians. I've written extensively on this issue, even though I am not Cherokee. Sometimes people think I am because Keeler is also a Cherokee surname in that tribe, and there was a chief named William Keeler. It is astounding, and they are dealing with it on a level that no one has to deal with in this country or even this world. I mean, no one pretends to be a member of any other country.
So, do you think that she's making a political calculation that she doesn't really want to deal with it in a forthright way because she thinks she'll lose something?
Yeah, and I did talk to some folks that the Cherokee Nation has tried really hard to talk to her, and she since 2011, and she has not been great at having a conversation with them. And I've been told a lot of things sort of off the record on background, and I'm going to be writing an article about it, and I'm getting some comments from the Cherokee Nation on the record as well, and that will be coming out in my next article. But it's so I don't want to say too much here, but basically to say that yes, she has not pursued an open conversation with the Cherokee leadership. She has tried to get around it in different ways. And I also was contacted by Native lawyers who were law students at Harvard while she was there, right? And I had recorded an interview with Rebecca Nagel, who is the Washington Post writer who wrote about the Warren issue, and the Cherokee from a Cherokee perspective. And I understand that, you know, she basically, Harvard did not pursue getting an actual woman of color because they felt they had that box checked by having her. So she did, in many ways, take the place of an actual...
Which is part of the controversy.
And then on top of that, the Native American Lawyer Student Association, Law Student Association, NALSA, tried many times to get her to come and speak to them for the several years that she was a professor there, and she would not come to see them. And so she had no relationship, no mentoring relationship with Native law students at Harvard Law. And you can see that in her, that she has no one on her staff from there. You would expect that if she was an actual really mentor sort of person, mentoring a whole generation of Native lawyers that came out of Harvard at that time period.
So you think this is going to continue to follow her around to some extent. I mean, maybe she just thinks that Native people are not that important in the overall vote or something.
Her behavior has been shocking. I mean, we really did not expect it. We expected her to have a conversation with us, you know, but she's more focused on one-upping Trump. And I think that goes to character, that goes to leadership. She is great. Everyone I talk to would support her.
Exactly.
You know,
that's the strange thing about it.
But now a lot of people are dialing it back. They're like, well, we think she'd make a good Treasury Secretary because that's where her skills are. And she was a Republican up to 1996.
Okay, so do you think she can still make this right?
I don't know. It goes to character. I mean, you know, there's a point where you these sorts of moments illuminate a person's personality, their character, their strengths, their weaknesses. And from the Native perspective, her response has been incredibly offensive and disrespectful to the sovereignty of the tribe she claims to be related to. And of course, there's also the Delaware Nation she also claims, and they have issues. They've actually told me they want to speak about this more. And the Cherokee genealogists are sharing the work that they did on her family tree with the Delaware. And there's no connections between her family and the Cherokee Nation. I should put that. They've done all the work. There are none. And she may be a 16th or a 1/1024th Peruvian, but what does that mean? I mean, it makes our citizenship, our identity meaningless if that's the case. You know, I'm a 16th French, but I am not French, you know, and I don't claim any sort of thing. I would never check the box. I would never, you know, even in a cookbook, you know, say that I'm a French person. You know, this is part and parcel of colonialism, of white, the whole thing of white supremacy is the way of the erasure of Native people. And by becoming us and taking our stories and trying to be us in our place, that is absolutely what the worst of America. Do you know what I mean? And so it's, and if American people do not want the continued genocide of Native people. They should support the political reality of Native people and not infringe upon and just assume our identity, just sneak over the border and assume it. Do you know what I mean? It's incredibly aggressive. It's an aggressive act against Native people.
I think it's almost an unconscious act in some ways. But it can't be anymore because she knows better.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, in Oklahoma, there was this whole history of white families trying to claim Cherokee blood so that they could get land. So then these, and also there's the other issue of mixed race ancestry. You know, her family, you know, might be part Black. And so like the term Blackfeet, a lot of people from the Southeast, white people from the Southeast say they're Blackfeet Indian. Yet Blackfeet, of course, live in Montana and their family trees have never been west of the Mississippi, right? So they're west of the Mississippi. Okay. Their family trees are east, they're in the Southeast. So, but basically it was a term for someone who was of mixed Black and white ancestry. So they're talking about having a Black ancestor, but they don't know it because they've redwashed it. They've made it Indian so that it's more acceptable to them. Their families did at some point. So there's a whole history in America that has nothing to do with Native people, but has everything to do with white supremacy and colonization. And these are a product of those stories.
Well, unfortunately, we will not get a chance to play the Rebecca Nagel. What I think we'll do is we'll try to actually get that into the KABU system and be able to link to that so people can hear it from when they go to our website, which is kboo.fm Wednesday Talk Radio. You can find it all there. We're about out of time.
I wanted to add one thing. I'm going to be doing more in-depth pieces through the new KABU show I'm doing, Not Your Disappearing Indian, which Paul is a producer on. And we will put a lot of these interviews together in a much more in-depth way and definitely do an episode on this.
Great. We got a couple more minutes. Or anything that you want to flag of stuff that you're working on or just things that the raid of the Unist-Totten camp is a big thing, which we should devote a whole hour to, that they've already arrested at least 14 people. It's way up in the frozen Northland, so it's, you know, of course Standing Rock was damn cold too, so it, you know, who knows if it's going to achieve anything like the note. But that's another thing that's been, you know, pushed off the pages when they don't, you know, when they cover things like Elizabeth Warren and don't focus on that. But there's the Northern Gateway pipeline, the Unist-Totten camp has been there for like a decade almost, I think maybe 8 years. And there's been a couple checkpoints, and they I think both checkpoints have now been dismantled. But anyway, that's something that people should look at. I'll try to link to that as well.
Yeah, and if you want to follow my Twitter, it's at JF Keeler, and I often share all of these updates on different Native news pieces, particularly about the camp. I've shared a lot from Canada. And once again, this plays into my critique of the U.S. and Canada as being colonies. And the colonial machine is all about, harvesting our wealth. And so even when you have an allegedly progressive person on top like Trudeau or even Obama, you know, the machine goes on. It continues to assault Native bodies to assert domination over Native lands.
Okay, thank you so much, Jacqueline. Once again, stay tuned a month from now, on the second Wednesday of every month, co-host Jacqueline Keeler will be with us again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Talk to you again.
Power in the blood. Power in the blood.